Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Welcome, everybody, to Defending in Numbers, the show where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we really do. Hello to all of you that are subscribed on Deezer, on iTunes. Make sure you rate, review and subscribe. Get us up that algorithm. Make us rich, famous and successful. When I say us, I mean myself, Rob Armstrong, Electric Avenue, George Elec.
I'm good. All right, hot as ever, but yeah, exciting.
And he's not talking about the temperature, I can tell you that much. And next to him, a man with a less exciting name, Jake Entwistle.
Just pure, you just had to go for it, yep. Less exciting, but I make up for it with my numbers.
Yeah, ladies, watch
out. You can
tell,
can't you?
Yeah, you walk into a pub and you see people flocking around as like all these sexy ladies and gents, and they're all talking, and then Jake comes in and gives a stat, and everyone flocks around in both genders flock to the stats. Speaking of stats, I suppose we should really crack on with our first feature, Week by Numbers.
The Week by Numbers.
And the first number we're going to start with is the number 7, which was the number Marcus Rashford was wearing on the back of his shirt, and also the number of take-ons he completed against Malta more than any other player, despite playing 45 minutes. Ryan Giggs, right, who I'm not sure is the best pundit out there. Great player, but I'm not sure is the best pundit. He said he's like Thierry Henry. Is Marcus Rashford the next Thierry Henry?
I think he's probably better than Thierry Henry was.
I know you're hot, but I don't need a hot take.
You could have let me finish when okay. Thierry Henry was 19.
Correct, I should.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I mean, the difference obviously being that Henry was a winger who was turned into a striker and looks like, you know, obviously Rashford only played up top for a very brief spell when he first came to the United team, but he's now been employed as a wide man. Last season, I was pretty scathing of Jose Mourinho's use of him on the flank, and he's made a mockery of me because he's definitely improved as a player by doing so, and he's become a much more rounded player. His performance against Slovakia as well, you know, he made a very bad mistake early on, and then he put it in the corner. What is it with England corner takers, by the way? But anyway, it was the corner in.
Sounds like the beginning of your stand-up set.
Yeah.
What is it with England corner takers? Am I right?
But for the first goal, and the second goal was absolutely pure class, and I'd say almost pure Henri. It was the way he was about to play a ball wide, and he saw the gap, and he did this really nice kind of dummy stroke with his... he grazed his boot against the grass, looked up, and then just wellied at bottom left. And that's pure Henri. So, you know, it's a bit pointless comparing players too, you know, carefully with former players, but I can see the similarities there, and I think he's a huge prospect.
Got a similarly hot take, Jake. Hot take, Jake.
We've got it for next time. Well, I'm going to disappoint because it's not going to be as hot as what George has said.
My hot take.
I do think that he's sort of just cemented his place as England's go-to wide man now. Obviously, Harry Kane is never going to be moved away from that centre-forward position. No matter what formation we play, really. So Marcus Rashford in these two games has shown that he is not only the most dangerous wide player we have in terms of direct running pace, but he's the most effective as well. He already got back-to-back assists in both those games. George mentioned the corner. He picked one up against Malta. As I said, the actual number in question is the take-ons, and that's something you associate with the likes of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Raheem Sterling. And Marcus Rashford is different in the fact that despite being younger than both of them, his time spent playing up front for Man United for the past two seasons means that when he does get into those areas where England need a player to make a decisive impact, we're relying on a 19-year-old to do it. And he single-handedly turned the game around against Slovakia. He was only one that was looking to shoot and looking to make the breakthrough. The fact he's made such an impact in that role is obviously bad news for the likes of Raheem Sterling and Oxlade-Chamberlain, because it looks like Rashford will be the first name on the team sheet for one of those wide positions. The other two are competing against each other.
I feel like other players might have melted after making the mistake for the first goal as well, because it was a classic young player trying to run through his own penalty box, wasn't it? Basically, for the rest of the game, he never hid once, did he? He wanted the ball the whole time, straight afterwards.
It's definitely what he's like as a player. I think you only have to look at the fateful Iceland game where England got knocked out of the Euros last year, and he was brought on way, way too late in the game, and he was basically the only player who ever looked like he was going to score after the Rooney penalty. So he's a player who's got that fearlessness about him. I think that the more he's played, and you know, he was part of a pretty poor United team last season and had to face up some pretty not criticism himself, but a team that faced up to a lot of criticism, and it doesn't seem to have rubbed off on him too much. So yeah, that energy, that youthfulness is something that we need to encourage and not squeeze out.
So you take the number 7 and then you put an 8 next to it, That makes 78, unless you're from one of the countries where they read from right to left, in which case it's 87. But we're not one of those countries. We're Roy Hodgson's England, reading from left to right. 78. The number of international goals Cristiano Ronaldo has scored. More than Pelé now. 78 goals at international level. And obviously, I know he's played a lot more games than a lot of the other players at the top of that chart have got, but it's still pretty impressive. But that being said, he is currently banned. So is this sort of spell for Portugal where he's just scored these two goals? Is he, how should I put it? Is he concentrating more on his country than other players do? Because there's obviously that big debate about club before country. He's achieved everything at club level, but Portugal still seems to mean so much to him, whereas maybe other players that have reached the top of their club, you don't see it so much.
Isn't that so depressing? That we're talking about it. It used to be a case where, you know, all players felt like playing for their country was the pinnacle. And, you know, the passion that we saw from Ronaldo in Paris last year when he went off injured and he was barking orders out on the touchline is something that you'd wish to see from England players more often. And I'm not sure if you do, whether or not, I mean, this suspension.
Milner and Southgate on the sideline.
He didn't have a choice about whether or not he can focus on his La Liga career at the moment because he's suspended. But there's no doubt that Ronaldo, for all his detractors and all the... Some people have a go at him for some things, but his passion and his commitment to Portugal is something that we can only laud.
I think what I was trying to get at is there was no kind of glimpse that he was trying to save himself for his return. He was going all out for his country and is just going to do that forever, right?
Yeah, that was his 48th career hat-trick, which again is like people don't score 144 goals. People don't score that in their career. He is an absolute marvel in terms of goal scoring. And I think that's mainly because of his drive and determination. In whatever sphere he's in, whether it's club level, whether it's youth level, whether it's for the national team, the one thing that seems to drive him is that pursuit of goals, the pursuit of records. And so he's second all-time top European scorer on an international level. He's Puskas is in front with 84. And no matter if he puts his Real Madrid career in jeopardy or either way, I can't see him retiring until he beats it. And that's what's made him such an incredible player. Is
what about that Iranian geezer? Is he Iranian at the top?
Yeah, he's on over 100. I don't think Ronaldo will beat that. But in terms of becoming Cristiano Ronaldo, the all-time top-scoring European ever, that is a title that will sit lovely with him. And
that Iranian geezer's never going to win a Euros either.
I think he could. You know, I mean, he could get over 100 for sure. Like he's still playing at the top level. He could he could continue playing for Portugal as long as he plays football if he wants to.
There's only another eight hat tricks or something.
Yeah, easy by the end of the year, especially with all these friendlies as well.
8 hat tricks, which doesn't add up to 103. That's how many years it's taken for Luxembourg to get a result against France. 103 years it's taken them. They had 74% possession, France, that is, 31 shots, and were 126 places above Luxembourg in the FIFA rankings. And yet the match finished 0-0. One of the sort of more England-y moments of France's football history, I think. How did they do it? Was it luck or was it just hard work? Are Luxembourg actually going to be a decent team? Was there any decent players in there? Or was it just an off night for France?
I think it was more of an off night for France. Griezmann missed 2 sitters on his weaker right foot. France, for all the criticism they got back at home, I don't think France in general are happy with Didier Deschamps at the helm. But they created more than enough chances to win that game. And although Luxembourg hit the post on this incredible counter-attack where Laurent Koscielny was made to look like an amateur footballer, which is really worrying. It seems like he's fallen off a cliff. But the France football are known at the moment for having one of the most attacking and exciting young sides.
Yeah, and 400 million quid or something.
Yeah, and I think Luxembourg's was 27,000, I think, total value. So
rip off.
There was a big disparity. But the thing that France fans are annoyed about, well, is the fact that they couldn't score goals. And their most exciting talent on the pitch was Kylian Mbappe, who's in the news at the moment. He was incredible in the first half and got taken off after 58 minutes. Mm. And they brought on Kingsley Coman, another attacking winger, and he didn't have the same impact. And I think that's what disgruntled the French fans, was that they couldn't score a goal against this Luxembourg side. They'd beaten them 16 times in a row before this, and they've drawn 0-0 at home. So no matter the fact of whether it was sort of a one-off, They still think it only gives them evidence to suggest that Deschamps won't be the right man to get the best out of this young squad.
Funny you mention Kingsley Coman, because it wasn't all that long ago we were talking about him like he was going to be the future Don Dapper of Ayia Napa. And now he's kind of just fell into the shadows of the Monaco gang, basically, hasn't he?
I mean, he didn't play enough last year, I think, and it's always the issue with these young talents is how they're going to progress. And obviously, all footballers go through hot streaks, and it seems like Kingsley Coman was certainly one who did that, and he's probably now going through a lull, and he'll probably come back stronger at some stage. But, I mean, in terms of this game, a couple of things just to point out is that Luxembourg obviously aren't a great footballing nation, but they're not necessarily necessarily the whipping boys that they've been before. This was the fifth point in their group, so you know, whilst in previous years this would have been an easy win, I think that now these days teams like Luxembourg and Malta as well, for their credit, who you know held England for a long time in that game as well, it's kind of a similar story to what Liverpool fans experienced last season, where if you've got this wealth of attacking talent and teams are just going there knowing that all they've got to do, all they need to do, all they're going to try and do is just stop you from scoring and get a 0-0 draw, it's actually very hard to break teams down. I'm not sure. I think that's something that's kind of become the case more and more these days, where the plucky underdog can kind of get their glory by just sitting back. So, I mean, it's pretty poor from France, but at the end of the day, it doesn't reflect in any way, in my opinion, of their chances next summer.
All right, the next number we're going for is the number 10, and we're talking Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola. So these two have faced each other 10 times. And Jurgen Klopp has won 5, Pep's won 4 times, but Pep has obviously won 2 Bundesliga titles and the German Cup at his expense. So they meet this weekend. Klopp won the first time in England and then they drew 1-1 in March. So how do you reckon this one is going to go between those two wonderful, charismatic managers?
I fancy Liverpool and Klopp. Their records against good teams has been exemplary under him. It's the poor teams they struggle against. When they can play on the counter-attack, they really excel. And, you know, there's no secret to how Pep Guardiola likes to play football. He doesn't really have a plan B. They top the pass completion metric with 1,886 so far. Pass accuracy metric with 87%. They top the possession metric with 63%. So we know that City are going to set up to dominate possession, to dominate the ball, and that plays into Liverpool's hands. If you look at chances created this season, City have created 37 to Liverpool's 35. But considering City have played Brighton, Everton and Bournemouth, you've got to think that they've had the easier games. And if you're looking at shots inside the box, City have had 27 compared to Liverpool's 36. So as far as I'm concerned, Liverpool have started the season better. I think that City are still just about my prediction to win the title, purely because over the season I think they'll be better. But this is the kind of game that Klopp's teams excel in. This is City dominating possession and the front line of the likes of Salah and Mane breaking speed. We know that City aren't great on the turn. We know that their defensive frailties can easily be exposed. So I'm positive that Liverpool can get a result.
How do you think these two have done in England? Because Jurgen Klopp, I mean, it's very small sections, but every now and again you see a Liverpool fan pop up on social media saying they want Klopp out. And then Pep Guardiola, obviously, it's his second season, but I think Man City, it's fair to say, they underperformed quite badly last year. Do you think they're going to go on to be massively successful with their clubs and win lots of silverware, or do you think maybe one, if not both, is perhaps riding a wave of hype more than they are actual sort of managerial credibility?
Yeah, I think the Jurgen Klopp has sort of finished riding that wave. The squad he's put together now is probably the most exciting and the best he's had whilst being at Liverpool. So this will be the real season that we see if Jurgen Klopp is the manager that everyone thinks he is and most likely is. He's obviously gone with this certain style at Liverpool, and just like adding to the numbers that George just said there, since taking over, Liverpool have made more tackles in the final third than any other team in the Premier League, and that's 164 to be exact. And that just speaks volumes about what he's tried to do since being at Liverpool, the same as what the possession statistics say about Man City. Klopp, I think, has succeeded in bringing that characteristic to his team. It just sometimes breaks down against the teams that aren't interested in keeping the ball in their own defensive third, so therefore negate the press that Klopp's looking to impose upon them. So in terms of Pep Guardiola as well, I think, again, he's been unfairly labelled as like the checkbook manager due to the spending this summer.
Guardiola.
Yeah, exactly. I think he gets a bit of stick considering that he inherited two very good teams, but he also helped build them. They weren't it wasn't just good players. He made them play in a very, very exciting way and won a lot of trophies because of it. And again, in a similar position to Jurgen Klopp, I think the fact that he did open his chequebook this year. He's bought the players that he needs. The fullbacks are going to be massive for them this season. Benjamin Mendy's finally fit, and I'm really looking forward to see him play. I think this will be the season where both of them, we can really make a conclusion on whether they are going to succeed in the Premier League, because they seem to both have all the tools that they need to fulfil their own plans and execute them in every match.
So no excuses anymore.
Yeah, that's probably the long and short of it.
Mind you, Klein, out of his back injury, poor old Oxlade Chamberlain turned down everywhere to play centre midfield, and now he's probably going to be filling in for Klein for the next 3 months, isn't he?
We've got Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, I keep saying Trent, I think. I think he's possibly even first choice when Klein's fit.
Yeah, he's, really?
Yeah, you learned something new there, didn't you?
I did. I'm Googling it right now, like Danny Rose.
One thing as well is Pep Guardiola's actually lost to Jurgen Klopp more times than any other manager. That five that we mentioned earlier, that's the most he's ever lost to a single manager. So I agree with George. I think Liverpool will win this one purely because Jurgen Klopp's style and what he wants to get from his team, this counter-attacking fast break team, is perfect against teams in possession.
Made up of 11 attacking midfielders.
Yeah.
So actually, let's just get a sort of score prediction. George.
3-1 to Liverpool.
I was genuinely going to say the same thing.
You guys should hang out more.
I know. I just think it will be like Liverpool go 1-0 up, Man City equalise, and then get too big for the boots and try and score another.
Well, if Liverpool are winning 2-1, it's not going to end that way. Something's going to give at either end because they'll be pouring forward.
All right, final number, 402. And what a large number. That's the number of chances created by Mesut Özil since moving to the Premier League. More than any other player. Also, more assists with 42. And one enormous Facebook post. Yeah. This week, which he said, stop shouting and start supporting or something, and said he loved his time at Arsenal, but then finished with, I don't know if I'm going to be here next year, which is always good to hear. What was all that about then, Jake?
We could have done a Mesut Özil special, really, because of what's happened this week.
It would be a little bit niche.
I know, but that's how sort of much I've been looking into this and trying to figure out which side is right. And I think it falls somewhere in between. Those numbers obviously show that he is a very good creative force. And I think that's the mistake. Mesut Özil won't be your sort of Christian Eriksen in terms of creating those chances and then scoring an incredible goal from the edge of the box. Mesut Özil has been sort of constructed to create boundless chances for his teammates. And during this international break, he already got two assists and a goal for Germany. Because in that system, they use him as the central point in their attack. He is the attacking midfielder. And they say, Mesut, you will create, and that's it. And in the Premier League and in English football, there's this agenda and this narrative that players should contribute to every phase of play, which I understand that you want to see players making tackles in every area of the pitch. But at Real Madrid, Mesut Özil was used as the playmaker. And just looking at his numbers during those three seasons in La Liga, I've sort of done a comparison of these 402 chances created to sort of make a point about why I feel like he gets...
Let's see if it matches up with mine.
Yeah. So in La Liga, he created 313 chances and got 47 assists. So he was getting assists every 6.66 chances created. Since moving to the Premier League, we mentioned the 402, which is equaling 42 assists, which is already less. And that's 9.57 chances created per assist. And I just feel like when you're playing in Real Madrid, you obviously have the best players around you. But people saying that Mesut Özil isn't doing his job for Arsenal, I'd say that he's doing exactly his job and what he should be doing. It's just the team selection and the system around him. The resources being sucked away from what he's good at. You've got Danny Welbeck up front, who has a 13% conversion rate since joining Arsenal. They've just bought a striker. When you exclude penalties, Alexandre Lacazette has a 22% conversion rate. If you put him up front and let Özil get back to doing what he does best, and I think this sort of idea that he's hiding or that he's not playing as well will sort of be eradicated very quickly.
George, you think it's rubbish, don't you?
No, I think it's brilliant. and I think that reminds me of something that Matt Letizia says about 20 years ago after he scored a brace against Newcastle and they interviewed
him. That's Ali Deer. Sorry.
Letiz is absolutely superb. Letiz was asked afterwards, they said, you know, he scored this unbelievable brace against Newcastle, arguably the best ever in the Premier League. And they said, how do you do it? And he says, well, you know, I walk around the pitch, when I get the ball, I try something good. When it doesn't come off, they call me lazy. I don't understand. I never do anything differently. And the same reminds me of Özil. Like, he can't be the player he is unless he plays the way he does. He can't be energetic or wear his heart on his sleeve because he wouldn't find the pockets of space he needs to find. He can't play the simple balls because he's not going to create if he does so. And the criticism he gets is almost as laughable as the praise he gets when it comes off, because there's a great player in there. He's an unbelievable, you know, creator. And as Jake said, when there's, if you've got a player there who can put it away, he's going to create goals for you. But if you're expecting him to be that grafter and that guy who's going to put a shift in and change his body language, it's never going to happen. But then he wouldn't be the player he is.
How do they, do, I don't know if either of you know, but how do they sort of see him abroad? Because obviously over here, the media is very much...
In Germany, they think he's an absolute star.
He's won German Player of the Year at least twice in the past 3 years. Only Thomas Müller in like the current squad that was just picked had more caps than him. He's got 37 assists and 22 goals for the German national team. That's an incredible involvement. As I said, it's because they... It helps that they've got Toni Kroos and Sami Khedira, Draxler, and these people coming through. But that's what I mean. It's at last season, Alexis Sanchez sucked a lot of the resources from Arsenal's system and the way they play. And at the beginning, that favoured Ozil. Ozil was scoring more goals. But in terms of getting the Ozil back that became world famous as the best number 10 in the world during his time at Real Madrid, if you want that to be seen at Arsenal, if that's what these pundits are expecting to see, then Arsene Wenger needs to rethink the makeup of this team at the moment, because it's not getting the best out of him. And because his chances aren't getting converted, the on the face of it numbers reflect really badly on him. When Arsenal lost to Stoke, he created three clear-cut opportunities. Hector Bellerin was on the receiving end of two of them. There's something wrong there if your primary playmaker is sliding in a through ball to a wing-back playing on the wrong side. If Arsenal can sort of figure out what they want to do and who they want to play, then Mesut Ozil's numbers, as I said, he's creating chances at a similar rate to Real Madrid. They're just not getting put away. I agree that maybe he's put his future in doubt. That was probably the wrong way to end the statement. But I'm on his side in terms of the fact that he is doing his job for Arsenal. It's just there are a lot of other problems that make him very easy to single out.
So, team Wrighty or team Ozil?
I'm team Mesut.
Yeah, team Mesut.
Both team Mesut. I'm going to go.
Sorry,
I'm a contrarian, so I'm going to go team Wrighty, and then I'm just going to end this segment and move on to I'm embarrassed to ask, so that no one can argue with me.
I'm embarrassed to ask.
All right then, I'm embarrassed to ask, because let's face it, I don't really know nothing. I know rude chants and cult heroes, some of them. What I don't know is how FIFA put together their world rankings. Because I'm looking at Switzerland number 4 at the moment. And how does that come about? I see, fair enough, I don't think England are in the top anything, right? But I'm seeing some teams in there and I just can't understand how they've got there. Argentina a couple of months ago were number 1, and I know they've been a bit shaky for the last few months. Now they're number 4. But no, are they no, now they're number 3, because Switzerland are number 4.
Look, Poland 5.
Poland are number 5? That's even more surprising than Switzerland are number 4.
Yeah. Denmark beat Poland 4-0 in this international break.
I'm disgusted by the
Denmark
FIFA
to number 1
chart. Someone tell me how they add it up, because I know there's two different types of chart as well. There's like a coefficient one as well, and I don't know anything about that either. I just hear coefficient, and sometimes I tweet it when an English team loses in Europe, because I know that it
protect
makes people angry. Yeah.
There's an article in the Times by James Gearbrandt.
Oh yeah, we're very close.
It's an interesting article, but where effectively apparently a Romanian data analyst or computer scientist sent a letter to the FA saying, you need to cancel these friendlies because it's going to cost you your seeding, and obviously they ignored it. But we, England, I should say, rather than we, had friendlies set up against Brazil and Ireland, I think, coming up. They were coming up, and effectively, because the way it's geared is that matches are weighted in terms of their importance, and merely by playing a friendly, which counts for 40% of that of a competitive fixture, you are weakening your... I think even a positive result, you weaken your standing within world football against those who don't play friendlies. So Switzerland and Poland, for example, Switzerland especially, play very, very few friendlies, and therefore don't play these games of lesser importance, and therefore don't do damage to their ranking position.
Oh, well, how don't they play friendlies? Surely ever does.
You don't have to. There's an international break for friendlies. You don't have to at all. And England are in a position where, because of things like Club Wembley, I don't think the FA can really afford, possibly can afford not to play them. But it's interesting. So James wrote this article, and a guy on Twitter called at Football Rankings Info.
Oh my God, he sounds like a barrel of dust.
So you can tell that he didn't know what he's talking about.
He better know some info about football rankings, otherwise he could meff off.
He put us on unbelievable, because he has the algorithm, he gets the algorithm, and he says that if England, because they then organised the one with Scotland afterwards, then we obviously played France a couple of months ago. If we hadn't played Brazil, Ireland and Scotland, we would have a 59-point Englandnesses. We would have a 59.84% chance of being seeded for next summer's World Cup. Because of playing those three friendlies, we now have a 0.01% chance of being seeded for the World Cup. And that is just for playing them. That's got nothing to do with whether or not you win, just by playing these games. So it's obviously a shame, because the FA were aware of this and they've said that they're going to reassess, and I think FIFA have said they're going to reassess the world rankings. Sad fact is that just by playing in these friendly matches, because they're weighted lower than other games, England done themselves damage, and they're going to be ranked at least second or third for the World Cup and probably come up against a good team and get beaten in the group stages.
So Jay, Switzerland, are they dodging friendlies because of this? Is that why they're dodging friendlies, or there's just no appetite for them?
Well, I think there's the...
Careful what you say here.
Exactly. I was going to say, the fact that letters are being sent to the FA saying you need to be aware of this suggests that other associations are aware of the impact that a friendly could have. And as we've said, there's no obligation to play a friendly. So if you're aware of something that can damage your chances in an international tournament, then by all means, like, if you're clever enough to spot that early, then I don't see why you should have to. But that's the problem, is there shouldn't ever be something in football where you're punished for playing a game. At the moment, the FIFA rankings are more a manipulation of your yearly calendar than they are a reflection of your talent as a football team. And when that's becoming the case to define a FIFA world rankings of best football teams in the world, that's when something's gone wrong. Another flaw in it is the fact that if you lose, you only ever get 0 points. So if you play Germany and you're ranked 50th in the world and you play the second best team in FIFA World Rankings at the moment and you lose, you get no points. But if you're then Germany and they lose to San Marino, they're not punished for losing to probably the worst team in European qualification. They still get naught. So there's no sort of... There's nothing that reflects well on a performance or punching the cliche of punching above your weight. If San Marino get a draw against Germany away,
they should hang their heads in shame.
They should be rewarded for getting that result, and you're not. So
especially in this day where, like, so far into how to analyse what matches and how to gain credit and how to assess how people are doing, it seems archaic that there isn't a method of just looking at performance and saying, right, you guys played unbelievably well, you might have lost, but you deserve to, you know, progress in the rankings for that reason.
Wales was playing less, because Wales are above us as well, I think, aren't they? Are they playing less friendlies?
No, I think they're like 18th. I think England are 13th.
Yeah, but they've jumped up massively, and I think it was because they spotted the trend. Yeah. And that was in the article in the Times.
Probably getting to semi-finals, the European Championships helps.
Yeah. But they mentioned that Wales, again, was sort of one of the associations that spotted the trend and thought, okay, let's just lower our friendlies a bit and we'll play the ones that we win. If we win, it doesn't reflect bad, but... Again, it's just being punished for organising calendar. And you say there should be a way to sort of analyse performances based on just every game and what you gain relative to your opponent. And there already is that in the FIFA Women rankings. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make sense that the FIFA rankings for the men are this based on this average that's calculated over every 4 years, whereas the women's rankings are based on every match you've ever played and they calculate an average. And that's how it should be. You can get the perfect
If it's every match you've ever played, if you've been quality for 5 years but rubbish for 40 years, does that mean you're not going to be somewhere down there?
That's the thing. I think the growth, again, just eventually, because you would have been bad, you would have got more points when you started winning games. So it will all equal out. The women's game showing where the men should go. Even if you lose in these games, you can still get, if there's 100 points on offer for a match, the losers can only get a maximum of 20% of the points. But if they do only lose narrowly 2-1 to Germany, they could get a high amount of points. Whereas if you get hammered 8-0, you will obviously get none. In the men's rankings at the moment, you can lose 24-0 or 2-0 and you only get punished by the same amount.
Which is a huge relief for us.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing, is that there's obviously a really good way of doing this and a bad way. And at the moment, only one is using the good way. And I don't understand why.
I'll tell you what the right way is. It's championship belt. Winner keeps it. Well, like, ranking
or just,
system.
Or just, like, how about it's a ladder where if you beat them, you just swap.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to have a human representative on a massive 200-rung ladder.
Imagine if France and Luxembourg had to have like a penalty shootout to see who, if like Luxembourg could get down to like 10th in the world, and France had like 100th. It would have been brilliant. Yeah, it's rubbish. But I think the press it's got recently, but it's not new.
It's always been.
There were articles written about it in 2013 before the 2014 World Cup. But it sounds like it's finally, because of just the ludicrous nature of the rankings at the moment and how skewed it looks like the draw is going to be next year. It looks like it'll probably be changed by the time we get to Euro 2020.
All algorithms. How am I meant to learn an algorithm? One algorithm I do know about is the one on iTunes, where if you rate, review and subscribe, we go up that. Also on Deezer, of course, and anywhere else where you find a podcast, make sure you do that. Before we go on to Who's This Fella, the next feature.
Who's this fella?
David Zappacosta. So Chelsea, they got him from Torino. Looks like a Victor Moses rival. So a right back. Not really sure how much I know about him. I know he's an Italian international, and that's about it. But there's been some pretty rogue players in that squad. Diamanti got in there for quite a while. Actually, didn't he score one of the penalties in the shootout against England?
Absolutely.
That's all he was used for, set of pieces.
I enjoyed him when he was in England, but yeah.
So, Zappacosta, what do we reckon of him going to Chelsea then? Is he just coming into... Is he going to replace Moses, or is he competition, or is he underneath Moses? What's the plan with him?
I think it's a really sharp signing because he offers something very, very different to Chelsea, because whilst Moses is the winger turned wing back, he's someone who's very good at taking players on. He's someone who's very good at tracking back with his pace and his athleticism and his strength. Whereas Zappacosta is a right back by trade who it looks will be converted into a right wing back, probably more in your Marcus Alonso style, and that he was not particularly quick and he's going to hold his position pretty firmly. But all you really need to know is his nickname amongst Chelsea fans now is David Zappacosta. Because he loves crossing. I'm sure Jake's got some very good stats about his crossing, but you know, he's basically just a guy who is known for his unbelievable ability to put the ball on a striker's head. And I'm sure Alvaro Morata, who's already scored two headers this season, is looking forward to profiting from that service.
How can I give him a nickname when they haven't seen him play yet?
It's because they've seen these numbers that I'm about to drop, and it all makes sense.
Are you telling me that like those Chelsea fans sitting in the Matthew Harding stand or whatever their sort of loud one is, they're sitting there going, wow, do you know he's got a cross completion of 64%?
It's actually only 22%.
Oh, well, but that is flogging them.
That is relatively high for crossing, because obviously
for those fans in the Matthew Harding stand. They much prefer 64%.
It's a very high risk sort of delivery. But so during his time in Serie A, it was at Atalanta and Torino. He put in 418 crosses, and that was one every 14 minutes if you look at his total time played. He was in the top three most crosses by defenders in Serie A in that time.
Who the other two?
Napoli, Goulam, and I had him written down, and he's escaped me.
You
know. I should have put him down.
Giuseppe.
It's Pasquale that played for Fiorentina for a bit, is now at Chievo.
Yeah, I remembered it. People call Giuseppe Smith.
That's
his nickname. That's what the Chelsea fans call him.
I'm so glad I actually remembered. So that's once every 14 minutes, as I said. And people, again, with crossing, I remember when Benjamin Mendy and Danilo were signed for Man City, everyone said, oh, they're going to have good fun crossing it into Gabriel Jesus, who's 6'8". A cross isn't defined by how far it goes off the floor. It's from a wide position, getting it in the box. And George mentioned Morata is good in the air, but also he's got great movement. That's what Conte's bought him for, is a bit more of a... Well, no, Diego Costa's movement is good as well, but Zappacosta will really enjoy sort of, doesn't need to get to the byline to cross. He'll be able to put it from a deeper position straight across the 6-yard box, and Morata will be the sort of player that thrives on that. So in that sense, Zappacosta will be sort of the mirror image of Marcus Alonso on the left. Marcus Alonso, again, is not the most graceful player. He's got a very nice left foot, but he looks quite awkward when he's running. He's taller than you'd expect a wing-back to be. Same as Zappacosta again. So Conte's obviously looked at Alonso, look at the success that Alonso brought to his side last year, and has now offered that on the right-hand side. Zappacosta will play wing-back for Italy when he's used more. Ventura's been using him more. And he's sort of... It's strange to say that Darmian is still like their first-choice wing-back, but Zappacosta's similar in that way. He's comfortable on the ball. He'll play right back, right wing back, and could probably play right wing if he ever needed to in an ultra defensive formation. But in him, they've bought this right wing back who will be a great deliverer of the ball and will definitely offer more tactical solidarity. Victor Moses, again, has been caught out a few times and does rely on his pace to recover, whereas Zappacosta is probably going to be in shape the whole time, not venturing too far forward and using his ability to cross the ball to cover distance rather than dribbling past players.
So the moves seem to come a little bit out of nowhere for me on deadline day, but did you know anything about it, George? You've got your ear to the ground on everything involving right backs, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I didn't know it was coming. I hadn't really heard much. I mean, these days it's pretty weird for a Premier League transfer, especially for a champion, to not be reported on. You get the feeling that half the stories that are reported on probably don't even exist. But no, it seemed to come out of the blue. Who knows if Chelsea even knew it was going to happen. Obviously, they've been linked with a host of fullbacks over the summer. And maybe it was just a case of this one becoming available late on. But that doesn't by any means mean that it's a bad signing. I'm pretty confident that even if he doesn't play every game this season, because there will be times where Moses and his pace and his attacking intent will be more useful. But I do think that he'll be someone who'll settle in well there and be an important player.
You reckon he's first choice more often than not?
I don't think you can really say that. Yeah. I think it's just horses for courses, really.
Yeah, I was about to say that getting Zappacosta rather than Oxlade-Chamberlain, who we spoke about before on this, maybe playing centre midfield sometimes. Oxlade-Chamberlain's skill set is very similar to Victor Moses. Yeah. And in buying him, they would have just bought someone if Moses got injured. In Zappacosta, now they have a player where if they need to be even more structured and rigid, they've got a defender and a right wing back that can add to the attack, but from a stationary position rather than relying on someone to venture forward and join the attack. So as George said, it's a different option to Victor Moses, so it's hard to tell which one will start more often than not. I've got a feeling he will eventually be the first choice purely because of how well Marcus Alonso slotted into what Conte wanted to achieve.
All right then, lads, enough about Zappacosta and on to the crucial part of this podcast. We're coming into, take deep breaths, both of you, because you're about to go to war. Stats Showdown.
Stats Showdown.
So this is basically a shoot-off between two stats cowboys, George and Jake. Hot take, Jake.
Hot take.
basically it's best out of three. We'll have three rounds. Impress me with a stat, because I need to sound smart in front of people and I don't want to be judged. I don't want people to say that's a boring stat. So I need you to impress me. George, you looked at me, so you can go first.
Well, mine's definitely not boring. It's a bit of a silly stat.
Whoa, hello.
One to tell your mates. Swansea, who play Newcastle at home this weekend, they've had 5 shots on target so far this season and already picked up 4 points. Spurs had the most shots last season, and if they had got them at the same rate, they'd have ended up with 283 points.
That is a wacky stat.
It's very wacky.
They don't call you wacky, Jake.
Have you ever heard the shots per point ratio?
Shots per point.
No, but it's something that I can imagine I'm going to have zero interest in my whole life.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
That's just rude.
As Spurs were mentioned, I'll go across and use a North London rival to rival the stat itself.
You are a hot take, Jake.
And if Arsenal lose to Bournemouth, it will be their worst ever start to a Premier League season after 4 games ever. And if they draw, it will be their joint worst. 4 points in 94 and 95 and 2011-12. Not going well for Arsene Wenger's side.
Not going well for you either, Jake. That was nowhere near as fun, wacky and silly as George's.
That was when you'll just see a match today on Saturday, won't you? You'll just see it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just come after it.
You're absolutely ruining me now.
I'm undefeated before today.
Oh, whatever. You've got a chance, though. Because you can come back with another shot from your stat gun.
Reloading, going back to Klopp and Pep Guardiola. Jurgen Klopp has won more points per game against last season's top 6 than he has against any other team in the league. He's currently got 36 points in 19 games versus big clubs, which is 1.89. And it's 1.82, 95 points from 52 games against all the other minnows.
Mm-hmm.
So it serves evidence that he's good in those big games.
Mm-hmm, but not good in the other ones, George.
Yeah, mine is also focusing on Liverpool and Man City this weekend on two of their key players, I'd say. Mohamed Salah and Kevin De Bruyne. Probably, in some ways, fairly similar players in terms of where they play, but not necessarily their style of play. Mohamed Salah has had 11 shots already this season in 3 games, all of which were inside the box. Kevin De Bruyne has had 7 shots this season, all outside the box, all on target, and he hasn't scored a goal.
That thump was me being blasted backwards by George's stat. Hot take, Jake. 2-0 down.
He's done it. My last one is rubbish as well.
I'm genuinely gutted. I'm fuming now.
He went for Fraudiola and Fraudlop.
I know this guy. He likes wacky stats.
I've got to go wacky next
I love
week.
Wacky stats, but Jake, while you're on the floor dying, why not give him a horrible scar?
I haven't got any wacky ones.
Oh, just give me an impressive one then.
I'll go to wacky, and then I go to Andy Robinson, who's probably the least wacky player in the Premier League. But he's
in the Premier League.
Andy Robinson, in his Liverpool debut against Crystal Palace, completed 92 passes. He averaged just 28 last season for Hull.
There we go. It turns out playing for a better team
means you get
to
the ball
play
more.
With better players and get the ball more. Go on, Jake, punish him.
All right, I'll just use Kylian Mbappe because I'm already lost. If he scores for PSG on his debut at the weekend, he's expected to play. He'll be the youngest ever player to score on their debut for at least 30 years. The archives were too old for me to look further back.
Anything where an archive becomes too old is quite good.
It depends whose archive you use.
Yeah. My archives, which I've been keeping for 3 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Have no records.
That's what I'm going to do next week. Before records began, when? Last week?
Yeah, I like a rundown archive, Jake. So it's 2-1. You got George with a sort of glancing blow to the jaw. Yeah. But chicks dig scars and stats, as I've said before. So if you want to hear some more stats from Jake, where can they find you online?
At Jake Entwistle on Twitter, simple as.
And George.
Yeah. At George Elek, E-L-E-K is how to spell my surname.
And you can find me at @RobArmstrong_WH. And also, don't forget, subscribe to Defending in Numbers on Deezer, iTunes and everywhere else where you find podcasts. Also, in your ears, which is where they are most of the time, right? Unless it's your brains when you're having to think about it. Right, lads? Yeah. On that note, we will see you next week on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.
Deezer Originals.